Chapter 17. Involuntarily reviewing the impressions left on his mind by the conversations at dinner and after, Karenin returned to his solitary room. What Dolly had said about forgiveness had merely vexed him. Whether or not to apply the Christian principle to his own case was too difficult a question to be lightly discussed, and Karenin had long since answered it in the negative. Of all that had been said, the words of the silly, good-natured Turovtsin had sunk deepest into his mind. He acted like a brick, challenged the other man, and killed him. Evidently, everybody had agreed with that, though they were too polite to say so. However, that point is settled and not worth thinking about, said Karenin to himself. And with nothing in his mind but his impending journey and his work of inspection, he went to his room and asked the doorkeeper, who followed him, where his valet was. The man replied that the valet had just gone out. Karenin ordered tea, sat down at a table, took up a timetable, and began planning his journey.
2 telegrams, said the valet, entering. Excuse me, Your Excellency, I had only just gone out.
Karenin took the telegrams and opened them. The first contained the news that Stremov had obtained the very appointment Karenin had been hoping for. He threw down the telegram and flushed. Rising, he began to pace the room. Quos vult pedere dementat, he thought, quos being those who had had a hand in making the appointment. He was vexed not so much at having missed that post himself and at having been obviously passed over, as at the incomprehensible and surprising fact that they did not realize how much less suitable than anyone else was that voluble windbag Stremov. How was it they did not see that by giving him that post they were ruining themselves and their own prestige? Something else of the same kind, he thought bitterly as he opened the second telegram. It was from his wife, and Anna, written in blue pencil, was the first word he saw. I am dying. I beg and entreat you, come. I shall die easier for your forgiveness, he read. Smiling contemptuously, he threw down the telegram. His first thought was that beyond doubt it was only falsehood and cunning. She would not hesitate at any deception. She was going to be confined. Perhaps that is the illness. But what can they be aiming at? To legitimize the child, compromise me, and prevent a divorce? He reflected. But there is something about dying. He reread the telegram and was suddenly struck by the direct meaning of the words. Supposing it is true, he said to himself, if it is true, and at the moment of suffering and approach to death she is sincerely repentant, and I, believing it to be false, refuse to come? It would not only be cruel and everybody would condemn me, but it would be stupid on my part.
Pyotr, keep the carriage. I am returning to Petersburg, he told the valet.
He decided to go back to Petersburg and see his wife. If the news of her illness were false, he would go away again, saying nothing. But if she were really ill and dying, and wished to see him before her death, he would, should he find her still living, forgive her, and should he arrive too late, he would perform his last duty to her. While on his way, he did not again think about what he should do. With the sense of fatigue and want of cleanliness resulting from a night spent in a railway carriage, Karenin drove through the fog of a Petersburg morning along the deserted Nevsky, looking straight before him and not thinking of what awaited him. He dared not think of it, because when he imagined what would happen, he could not drive from his mind the thought that her death would at once dissolve all the difficulties of the situation. Bakers, the closed shops, night izvozchiks, and men sweeping the pavements passed before his eyes. And watching all this, He tried to stifle the thought of what lay before him, and of what he dared not desire, and yet could not help desiring. The carriage stopped at the porch. A carriage with a coachman asleep on the box and an izvoshchik was standing at the entrance. As he entered the hall, Karenin dragged forth his resolve, as it were, from a remote corner of his brain, and conned it over. It said, "If it is all a fraud, then calm contempt and leave again. If true, keep up appearances." The door was opened by the hall porter before Karenin had time to ring. The porter, Petrov, otherwise Kapitonich, looked strange in an old coat without a tie and in slippers. "How is your mistress?"
"Safely delivered yesterday."
Karenin halted and turned pale. Now he clearly realized how much he had desired her death. "And her health?" Corneille, wearing his morning apron, came running downstairs.
"Very bad," he said. "There was a consultation yesterday, and the doctor is here now."
"Take my things," said Karenin. And somewhat relieved by the news that there was still some hope of her dying, he entered the anteroom. On the hall stand was hanging a military coat, and he noticed it.
"Who is here?" "The doctor, the midwife, and Count Vronsky."
Karenin passed on to the inner apartments. There was no one in the drawing room, but the midwife, with lilac ribbons in her cap, came out of Anna's boudoir. She approached Karenin, and with a familiarity bred by death's approach, took him by the hand and led him toward the bedroom. "Thank God you have come. She talks only about you, and nothing but you," said she.
"Be quick and bring the ice,"
came the authoritative sound of the doctor's voice from the bedroom. Karenin entered the boudoir. Beside the table, sitting with his side toward the back of a low chair, was Vronsky, his hands covering his face, weeping. At the sound of the doctor's voice, he jumped up, uncovered his face, and saw Karenin. But at sight of her husband he was filled with such confusion that he again sat down, drawing his head down between his shoulders as if trying to become invisible. Then, making an effort, he rose and said,
"She is dying. The doctors say there is no hope. I am entirely in your hands. But allow me to remain here, please. However, I am in your hands.
The sight of Vronsky's tears made Karenin aware of the approach of that mental perturbation which other people's visible sufferings always aroused in him, and turning away his head, he went toward the door without heeding what Vronsky was saying. Anna's voice, talking about something, came from the bedroom. It sounded cheerful and animated, and its articulation was extremely distinct. Karenin entered and went up to the bed. She lay with her face toward him. Her cheeks were rosy red, her eyes glittered, and her little white hands, from which the cuffs of her dressing jacket had been pushed back, toyed with the corner of the blanket, twisting it. She appeared not only fresh and well, but in the best of spirits. She spoke rapidly in a ringing voice with extraordinarily accurate intonations, full of feeling. "Because Alexei, I am speaking of Alexei Alexandrovich, how strange and terrible that they are both called Alexei, is it not? Alexei would not have refused me. I should have forgotten, and he would have forgiven. But why does he not come? He is kind. He himself does not know how kind he is. Oh, God, what weariness! Give me some water, quick. Oh, but it will be bad for her, for my little girl. Well, all right. Well, let her have a nurse. Well, I agree, it will be better so. He will come back, and it will pain him to see her. Take her away." "Anna Arkadyevna, he has come. Here he is," said the midwife, trying to draw Anna's attention to Alexei Alexandrovich.
"Oh, what nonsense!"
Anna went on, taking no notice of her husband.
"But let me have her. Let me have my little girl. He has not come yet. You say he won't forgive me because you don't know him. No one knew him, only I. And even for me it has become hard. One must know his eyes. Seretse's are just the same. That's why I can't bear to see them. Have they given Seretse his dinner? Oh, don't I know that everybody will forget? He would not forget. Seretse must be moved into the corner room, and Mariette must be asked to sleep with him."
Suddenly she recoiled, became silent and frightened, and put her arms before her face as if in expectation of a blow. She had seen her husband.
"No, no,"
she began again.
"I am not afraid of him. I am afraid of death. Alexei, come here. I am in a hurry because I have no time. I have not long to live. I shall soon become feverish, and then I shall no longer understand anything. Now I understand everything and see everything."
Over Karenin's drawn face came a look of suffering. He took her hand and was about to say something, but could not speak. His lower jaw trembled. He struggled with his agitation, every now and then glancing at her. And every time he did so, he saw her eyes looking at him with such tender and ecstatic emotion as he had never before seen in them.
"Wait a bit. You don't know. Wait, wait."
She paused, as if to collect her thoughts.
"Yes," she continued. "Yes, yes, yes. This is what I wished to say. Don't be surprised at me. I am still the same. But there is another in me as well, and I am afraid of her. She fell in love with that other one, and I wished to hate you, but could not forget her who was before. That other is not I. Now I am the real one, all of me. I am dying now. I know I am. Ask him. Even now I feel it. Here they are, my hands and feet and fingers. Whole hundredweights are on them. My fingers. See how enormous they are. But all this will soon end. I only want one thing. Forgive me. Forgive me completely. I am dreadfully bad, but the nurse told about the holy martyr. What was her name? She was worse, and I shall go to Rome. There is a wilderness there, and then I shall be in nobody's way. I shall only take Seretse and the little girl. No, you cannot forgive me. I know that I cannot be forgiven. No, no, go. You are too good."
With one hot hand she held his, while with the other she pushed him away. The perturbation in Karenin's soul went on increasing and reached a point where he gave up struggling against it. Suddenly he felt that what he had taken for perturbation was, on the contrary, a blissful state of his soul, bringing him joy such as he had never before known. He was not thinking that the law of Christ, which all his life he had tried to fulfill, told him to forgive and love his enemies, but a joyous feeling of forgiveness and love for his enemies filled his soul. He knelt with his head resting on her bent arm, which burnt through its sleeve like fire, and sobbed like a child. She put her arm round his bald head, moved closer to him, and looked up with an expression of proud defiance.
"Here he is. I knew. Now, goodbye to all. Goodbye." "They have come again.
Why don't they go away? Oh, take these furs off me.
The doctor moved her arms and carefully drew the bedclothes over her shoulders. She meekly lay down on her back and gazed with radiant eyes straight before her.
Remember that the only thing I want is your forgiveness. I wish for nothing else. Why does he not come in?
She cried, calling to Vronsky on the other side of the door.
Come! Come! Give him your hand.
Vronsky came to her bedside, and on seeing Anna, again hid his face in his hands.
Uncover your face. Look at him. He is a saint,
said she.
Uncover, yes, uncover your face,
she went on angrily.
Alexei Alexandrovich, uncover his face. I want to see him.
Karenin took Vronsky's hands and moved them away from his face, terrible with its look of suffering and shame.
Give him your hand. Forgive him.
Karenin held out his hand without restraining the tears that were falling.
Thank God! Thank God!
She cried.
Now everything is ready. Only stretch out my legs a little. That's right. Now it's splendid.
How badly those flowers are drawn, not a bit like violets. And she pointed to the wallpaper.
Oh, my God! My God! When will it all come to an end? Doctor, give me some morphia. Oh, my God! My God!
And she began to toss in her bed. The doctor and his colleague said it was puerperal fever, which in 99 cases out of 100 ended fatally. All day she was feverish, delirious, and unconscious. At midnight she lay insensible, with hardly any pulse. The end was expected every moment. Vronsky went away, but came again in the morning to inquire. Karenin met him in the anteroom and said, "Remain here. She may ask for you." And himself showed him into Anna's boudoir. Toward morning she had become excited and animated, and her thoughts and words flowed rapidly. But again this state lapsed into unconsciousness. On the third day she was just the same, and the doctors gave some hope. That day Karenin went out into the boudoir where Vronsky sat, and having locked the door, took a seat opposite him.
Alexei Alexandrovich, said Vronsky, feeling that an explanation was coming. I am unable to think, unable to understand. Spare me. However painful it may be to you, believe me, it is still more terrible for me.
He was about to rise, but Karenin took him by the hand and said,
I beg you to hear me. It is necessary.
I must explain to you my feelings, those that have guided me and will guide me in future, so that you may not misunderstand me. You know that I resolved on a divorce and had even taken steps toward obtaining it. I will not conceal from you that when I took action, I was in a state of indecision. I suffered, and I confess that I was haunted by a desire for vengeance. On receiving the telegram, I came here with the same feelings. More than that, I wished for her death. But he stopped and reflected whether he should reveal his feelings or not. But I saw her, and forgave her. And the joy of forgiving has revealed my duty to me. I have wholly forgiven. I want to turn the other cheek. I want to give my cloak because my coat has been taken. I only pray God that the joy of forgiving may not be taken from me. Tears filled his eyes, and their clear, calm expression struck Vronsky. That is my position. You may trample me in the mud, make me the laughingstock of the world. I will not forsake her, and will never utter a word of reproach to you, continued Karenin. My duty is clearly defined. I must and will remain with her. If she wishes to see you, I will let you know. But now I think it will be best for you to leave. He rose, and sobs broke his voice. Vronsky got up at once, and stooping before him, looked up into his face without unbending his back. He could not understand Karenin, but felt that here was something high and inaccessible to one with his outlook on life. Chapter 18. After his conversation with Karenin, Vronsky went out onto the Karenin's porch and then stopped, recalling with difficulty where he was and where he ought to go. He felt ashamed, humiliated, guilty, and deprived of the possibility of cleansing himself from his degradation. He felt himself knocked quite out of the rut along which he had hitherto trodden so proudly and so lightly. All the apparently solid habits and rules of his life suddenly seemed false and inapplicable. The deceived husband, who up till now had appeared a pitiful creature, an accidental and rather ridiculous obstacle to his happiness, suddenly recalled by her and raised to a pedestal that inspired the utmost respect, that husband in his lofty elevation turned out to be not only not cruel, false, or absurd, but kind, simple, and dignified. Vronsky could not help being conscious of this. They had suddenly exchanged roles. Vronsky felt Karenin's greatness and his own humiliation, Karenin's rightness and his own wrongdoing. He felt that the husband in his sorrow was magnanimous, while he himself was mean and trivial in his deceptions. But the consciousness of his degradation toward the man whom he had unjustly despised accounted for but a small portion of his grief. He was unspeakably miserable because his passion for Anna, which he imagined had of late begun to cool, had become even stronger now that he knew her to be lost to him forever. During her illness he had learnt to know her thoroughly, had seen into her very soul, and it seemed to him that he had never loved her before. And just now, when he knew her and loved her in the right way, he had been humiliated before her and had lost her forever, leaving her nothing but a shameful memory of himself. But most terrible of all was the ridiculous, shameful figure he had cut when Karenin was pulling his hands from before his shame-suffused face. He stood in the porch of the Karenin's house as one in a maze, and did not know what to do next.
"Shall I call an izvozchik?" inquired the hall porter. "Yes, an izvozchik."
Returning home after the three sleepless nights, Vronsky did not undress but lay down prone on a sofa with his head on his folded arms. His head was heavy. Fancies, memories, and most strange thoughts followed one another with extreme rapidity and clearness. Now he saw himself pouring out medicine for the patient and overfilling the spoon. Then he saw the midwife's white hands, or Karenin's curious pose as he knelt on the floor by her bedside. "To sleep. To forget," he said to himself, with the calm certainty of a healthy man that being tired and in want of sleep he would at once fall asleep. And in fact, in a moment his thoughts grew confused, and he began to fall into the abyss of forgetfulness. The waves of the sea of unconscious life were beginning to close over his head, when all at once he felt as if he had received a violent electric shock. He started so violently that his whole body was thrown upwards on the springs of the sofa, and leaning on his hands, he rose to his knees in fear. His eyes were wide open, as if he had not slept at all. The heaviness of his head and the languor of his limbs, of which he had been aware a moment previously, had suddenly vanished. "You may trample me in the mud," he seemed to hear Karenin saying. And he saw Anna's feverishly flushed face and brilliant eyes gazing not at him, but at Karenin. He saw his own, as it seemed to him, stupid and ridiculous figure when Karenin was drawing his hands away from his face. He stretched out his legs and again threw himself upon the sofa in the same position as before and shut his eyes. "Sleep. Sleep," he kept repeating to himself. But with his eyes closed, he could see yet more distinctly Anna's face as he had seen it on that memorable evening before the race. "All that is ended and never will be again, and she wishes to efface it from her memory. I can't live without it. Then how can we be reconciled? How can we be reconciled?" said he aloud, and went on unconsciously repeating those words. This reiteration prevented other images and memories which were thronging his brain from arising. But the repetition of those words did not long hinder his imagination from working. Again, following each other with great rapidity, his happiest moments rose in his fancy, and with them his recent humiliation. "Take away his hands," Anna's voice is saying. Karenin pulls away his hands, and he is conscious of the shame-suffused and stupid expression of his own face. He still lay trying to fall asleep, though he had lost all hope of succeeding, and kept repeating in a whisper random words connected with disjointed thoughts in order to prevent other images from rising. He listened and heard repeated in a strange, mad whisper the words, "Unable to value, unable to enjoy, unable to value, unable to enjoy." "What is this? Am I going mad?" he asked himself. "Perhaps. What else makes people go mad? What makes them shoot themselves?" he replied to his own thought. And opening his eyes, he was surprised to see, close to his head, an embroidered cushion worked by Varya, his brother's wife. Fingering a tassel of the cushion, he tried to think of Varya as he had last seen her. But to think of anything extraneous was painful.
"No, I must sleep."
He moved the cushion and pressed his head against it, but his eyes would not remain closed without effort. He jumped up and sat down.
"That's at an end for me," he thought. "I must think over what I must do. What is left me?"
His thoughts glided quickly over his life, unconnected with his passion for Anna.
"Ambition? Serpukhovsky? Society? The court?"
He could not dwell on any of these things. He rose from the sofa, took off his coat, loosened the strap, and, baring his shaggy chest to breathe more freely, walked across the room.
"That's how one goes mad," he said again. "And how one shoots oneself so as not to be ashamed," he concluded slowly.
Going up to a door, he closed it. Then, with fixed gaze and tightly clenched teeth, approached the table, took up his revolver, examined it, turned it to a loaded chamber, and pondered. For a minute or two he stood motionless with bowed head, a strained expression of effort on his face, holding the revolver in his hand. Of course, he said to himself, as if led to a definite conclusion by a logical, continued, and clear line of reasoning. In reality, that convinced "of course" was merely the outcome of the repetition of a round of fancies and recollections similar to those he had already gone over dozens of times in the last hour. They were the same memories of happiness lost forever, the same thoughts of the senselessness of all that life had in store for him, and the same consciousness of his humiliation. And they followed in the same rotation. Of course, he said again, when thought returned a third time to that point in the enchanted circle of memories and ideas. And placing the revolver against the left side of his chest, with a strong movement of his whole hand as if to clench the fist, he pulled the trigger. He did not hear the sound of a shot, but a powerful blow on the chest knocked him off his feet. He wished to steady himself by the table, dropped the revolver, reeled, and sat down on the floor, looking about him in astonishment. He did not recognize his room as he looked up at the curved legs of the table and at the waste paper basket and the tiger skin rug. The quick step of his servant coming through the drawing room brought him to his senses. He made an effort and understood that he was on the floor, and seeing blood on the tiger skin and on his hand, realized that he had tried to shoot himself.
Stupid. Missed,
he muttered, feeling with his hand for the revolver. It was close to him, but he sought it further away. Continuing his search, he leant over to the other side, and unable to keep his balance, fell down, bleeding. The elegant servant with the whiskers, who often complained to his friends about the weakness of his nerves, was so upset when he saw his master lying on the floor that he left him to bleed to death and ran away to get help. In an hour's time, Varya arrived, and with the assistance of three doctors whom she had summoned from every quarter and who all arrived at the same time, she got the wounded man to bed, and then stayed in the house to nurse him. Chapter 19. The mistake Karenin had made when, preparing to see his wife, he had not considered the possibility either of her repentance being real or of her recovery, faced him in all its significance 2 months after his return from Moscow. But this mistake was not entirely caused by his omitting to consider that contingency, but also by the fact that, up to the day when he was face to face with his dying wife, he had not known his own heart. By his sick wife's bedside, he had, for the first time in his life, given rein to that feeling of tender sympathy which the suffering of others evoked in him, and which he had till then been ashamed of as of a weakness. And his pity for her, remorse at having wished for her death, and above all the joy of forgiving, in itself gave him not only relief from suffering, but inward peace such as he had never before experienced. Suddenly he felt that the very thing that had been a source of suffering to him had become a spiritual joy, and that what had seemed insoluble as long as he indulged in censure, recriminations, and hatred had become simple and clear when he forgave and loved. He forgave his wife and pitied her for her sufferings and remorse. He forgave Vronsky and pitied him, especially when reports of Vronsky's desperate action reached him. He pitied his son, too, more than he had done before, and reproached himself for not having paid more attention to him. But for the newborn little girl he had a peculiar sentiment, not of pity alone, but even of tenderness. At first, commiseration alone drew his attention to the delicate infant, not his daughter, who had been neglected during her mother's illness and would certainly have died then had it not been for his solicitude. And he himself hardly knew how he grew fond of her. Several times a day he went to the nursery and remained there so long that the nurses, who had been shy in his presence, became quite used to him. Sometimes he would sit for half an hour gazing at the saffron and red, downy, wrinkled little face of the sleeping infant, watching the movements of the frowning little forehead and the plump little hands with the bent fingers and palms that rubbed the tiny eyes and nose. At such moments especially, Karenin felt quite calm and at peace with himself, seeing nothing exceptional in his position and nothing that ought to be altered. But as time went on, he saw more and more clearly that, however natural his position might appear to him at the time, he would not be allowed to remain in it. He was conscious that, beside the good spiritual force which governed his soul, there existed a coarse power, as potent, if not more so, and that this power would not grant him the humble peace he desired. He felt that everybody looked at him with questioning surprise, without understanding him, expecting something from him. And especially he was aware of the insecurity and artificiality of his relation to his wife. When the softened mood caused by the nearness of death had passed, Karenin began to notice that Anna feared him, was oppressed by his presence, and avoided looking him straight in the eyes. It was as if she wished, yet could not make up her mind, to say something, and foreseeing that their present relation could not continue, expected something from him, too. At the end of February, Anna's newborn daughter, also named Anna, happened to fall ill. Karenin had been in the nursery that morning, and having given orders to send for the doctor, had gone to the department. Toward 4 o'clock, having finished his work, he returned home. On entering the anteroom, he saw there a handsome footman in gold-braided livery with a bearskin cape, holding a cloak lined with white fur.
"Who is here?" asked Karenin.
"Princess Elizabeth Fedorovna Tverskaya," answered the footman with a smile, as it seemed to Karenin.
All through that difficult time, Karenin noticed that all his worldly acquaintances, especially the women, displayed a particularly lively interest in him and his wife. He noticed in all these acquaintances a kind of joy which they suppressed with difficulty, like the joy he had noticed in the lawyer's eyes, and again, just now, in the footman's. Everybody seemed elated, as if they were giving someone in marriage. When they met him, they inquired, with scarcely hidden pleasure, about Anna's health. The presence of Princess Tverskaya and the memories associated with her, coupled with the fact that he had never liked her, was unpleasant to Karenin, and he went straight to the nursery. In the front nursery, Seretse, lying with his chest on the table and his legs on a chair, was drawing something and chattering merrily. An English nursery governess, who since Anna's illness had replaced the French governess with the boy, sat doing some crochet work. She hurriedly rose, curtsied, and nudged Seretse. Karenin passed his hand over his son's hair, answered the governess's inquiry about Anna's health, and asked what the doctor had said about baby. "The doctor says there is no danger and has ordered baths, sir."
"But she is still suffering," remarked Karenin, listening to the crying child in the next room.
"I think the nurse is unsuitable, sir," said the Englishwoman with decision.
"Why do you think so?" he asked, stopping short.
"The same thing happened in Countess Paul's case. The baby was medically treated, and then it turned out to be merely hungry and nothing more. The nurse has no milk, sir."
Karenin reflected a moment and then entered the other room. The little girl lay with her head thrown back, wriggling in the wet nurse's arms, and would neither take the breast nor cease screaming, despite the hushing of 2 nurses who were bending over her.
"Still no better?" asked Karenin.
"Very restless," said the head nurse in a whisper.
"Miss Edwards says that perhaps the nurse has no milk," he said.
"I think so too, Alexei Alexandrovich."
"Then why did you not say so?"
"Whom could I speak to? Anna Arkadyevna is still ill," said the old nurse in a dissatisfied tone.
The nurse was an old family servant, and in her simple words Karenin thought he noticed a hint at his position. The baby screamed louder, catching her breath and growing hoarse. The old nurse, with a gesture of vexation, came up and took her from the wet nurse and began pacing up and down, rocking the baby in her arms. "The doctor must be asked to examine the nurse," said Karenin. The healthy-looking wet nurse in her finery, evidently afraid of being dismissed, muttered something to herself as she covered her well-developed breast and smiled contemptuously at the idea of her not having sufficient milk. In that smile also, Karenin thought he saw himself and his position ridiculed.
"Unfortunate child," said the nurse, hushing the baby and continuing to walk up and down with it.
Karenin sat down on a chair, and with a look full of suffering and weariness, watched the nurse as she paced the room. When the child was pacified and laid in her deep cot, and the nurse, after smoothing the little pillow, went away, Karenin rose, and stepping with difficulty on tiptoe, approached the infant. For a moment he stood silent, regarding the child with the same weary expression. But suddenly a smile, wrinkling the skin on his forehead and making his hair move, lit up his face, and he quietly left the room. He rang the bell in the dining room and told the servant to send for the doctor once more. He was vexed with his wife for not troubling about the charming baby, felt disinclined to go in and see her while in that frame of mind, and also disinclined to meet the Princess Betsy. But his wife might think it strange if he did not come in as usual, and so he mastered himself and went to her bedroom. Stepping on the soft carpet, as he approached the door, he involuntarily overheard a conversation which he had no wish to hear. "If he had not been going away, I should understand your refusal, and his too. But your husband must be above that," Betsy was saying.
"It is not for my husband's sake, but for my own, that I don't wish it. Don't talk about it," answered Anna in an excited voice.
"Yes, but you can't but wish to say goodbye to a man who tried to shoot himself for your sake. It's just for that reason that I don't wish it." Karenin, with a frightened and guilty face, stopped short and thought of returning unnoticed. But coming to the conclusion that this would be undignified, he turned, coughed, and went toward the bedroom door. The voices were silent, and he entered. Anna, in a grey dressing gown, with her black hair cropped short, but already growing again like a thick brush over her round head, sat on a couch. As usual, when she saw her husband, all her animation vanished from her face. She bowed her head and glanced uneasily at Betsy. Betsy, dressed in the very latest fashion, her hat soaring high above her head like a little chimney coronet over a lamp, in a dove-coloured dress with very pronounced diagonal stripes going one way on the bodice and the other way on the skirt, was sitting beside Anna, her flat, tall figure very erect and her head bent. She met Karenin with an ironical smile.
"Ah," she exclaimed, as if in surprise, "I'm so glad you're at home. I have not seen you since Anna's illness. I have heard everything, all about your attentiveness.
Yes, you are a wonderful husband," she said, with a significant and affable expression, as if she were conferring on him an order of high-mindedness for his conduct toward his wife. Karenin bowed coldly, and kissing his wife's hand, asked about her health.
"I think I am better," she said, avoiding his eyes.
"But your face looks feverish," said he, emphasizing the word feverish.
"We have been talking too much," said Betsy. "I know it was selfish of me, and I am going."
She rose, but Anna, suddenly blushing, quickly seized her hand.
"No, please stay. I must tell you,
and she turned toward her husband, the color spreading over her neck and forehead.
"I don't wish to hide anything from you."
Karenin cracked his fingers and bowed his head. "Betsy says Count Vronsky wanted to come and say goodbye before leaving for Tashkent." She was not looking at her husband, and evidently was in a hurry to get through what she meant to say at any cost.
"I said I could not receive him." "You said, my love, that it would depend on Alexei Alexandrovich, Betsy corrected her. Oh, no, I can't receive him, and it would lead...
She stopped suddenly and glanced inquiringly at her husband, who was not looking at her.
In a word, I don't wish...
Karenin drew nearer and was going to take her hand. Her first impulse was to draw away her hand from his moist one with the thick swelling veins that was seeking hers, but with evident effort she pressed it.
I am very grateful for your confidence, but...
He began in confusion, feeling with vexation that what he could so clearly decide within himself he was unable to discuss in the presence of the Princess Tverskaya, who appeared to him the personification of that coarse power which would rule his life in the eye of the world, and which prevented him from yielding to his feelings of love and forgiveness. He stopped and looked at the princess.
Well, goodbye, my precious, said Betsy, rising again.
She kissed Anna and went out. Karenin followed her.
Alexei Alexandrovich, I know you to be a really high-minded man, said Betsy, stopping short in the little sitting-room and once again pressing his hand with peculiar warmth. I am only an outsider, but I'm so fond of her and respect you so much that I will take the liberty of advising you.
Receive him. Alexei Vronsky is honor personified. And besides, he is leaving for Tashkent.
Thanks for your sympathy and advice, Princess. But the question whom my wife will and whom she will not receive, she will decide for herself. He said this from force of habit, with a dignified raising of his eyebrows, but immediately remembered that whatever he might say, there could be no question of dignity in his position, and saw the confirmation of this in the suppressed, cruel and ironical smile with which Betsy glanced at him when he had spoken. Chapter 20 Karenin took leave of Betsy when they reached the dining-room and returned to his wife. She was lying down, but on hearing his step she quickly sat up in her former place and glanced at him with apprehension. He saw that she had been crying.
"I am very grateful to you for your confidence," he repeated in Russian what he had said in French in Betsy's presence.
When speaking Russian to her he called her thou, and that always irritated her.
"And I am very grateful for your decision.
I, too, think that, as he is going away, there is no need whatever for Count Vronsky to come here.
However, but I have already said so. Then why repeat it?"
Anna suddenly interrupted him, with an irritation she could not repress.
No need whatever, she thought, for a man to come and take leave of a woman he loves, for whose sake he wanted to die and has ruined himself, a woman who cannot live without him. No need whatever.
And she pressed her lips together and lowered her glistening eyes, looking at his hands with their swollen veins, which he was slowly rubbing together.
Let us say no more about it, she added more calmly.
I left it to you to decide the matter, and am very glad to see, began Karenin,
that my wish coincides with yours.
She rapidly completed his sentence, exasperated by the slowness with which he spoke, and knowing beforehand what he would say. He assented.
Yes, and Princess Tverskaya's intrusion into this most difficult family matter is entirely out of place, especially as she...
I don't believe anything they say about her, Anna put in quickly.
I know that she is sincerely fond of me.
Karenin sighed and paused. She was agitatedly toying with the tassels of her dressing gown, glancing at him with that tormenting feeling of physical repulsion for which she blamed herself, but which she could not overcome. The one thing she was longing for was to get rid of his obnoxious presence.
I have just sent... for the doctor, said he.
I am quite well. Why should I need the doctor?
Yes, but the little one keeps screaming, and they say the nurse has not enough milk.
Then why would you not let me nurse her when I entreated you to? She is a child, anyhow.
He understood what she meant by that, anyhow.
And they will kill her.
She rang and ordered the baby to be brought.
I asked to be allowed to nurse her, and I wasn't. And now I am blamed.
I don't blame...
Yes, you are blaming me. Oh, God, why did I not die?
And she began to sob.
Forgive me. I am upset. I am unjust.
She went on, controlling herself.
But... go.
No, it can't go on like that, he told himself with conviction after leaving his wife. Never before had his impossible situation, as the world thought it, his wife's hatred and the strength of that coarse power, which, in direct opposition to his inward mood, dominated his life and demanded fulfillment of its decrees and a change in his relation to his wife, never before had the impossibility of his position appeared so evident. He saw clearly that the world and also his wife were demanding something from him, but exactly what this something was he did not comprehend. All this was arousing a feeling of animosity in his soul, spoiling his peace of mind and depriving his achievement of all value. He considered it better for Anna to break off her relations with Vronsky. But if everyone thought this impossible, he was even ready to allow those relations to be renewed, so long as no slur was thereby cast on the children. He was not deprived of them, and his position was not altered. Bad as this would be, it would be preferable to a complete rupture which would place her in a hopeless and shameful position and deprive him of all he loved. But he felt powerless. He was aware in advance that everybody would be against him and that he would not be allowed to do what now seemed so natural and good, that he would be obliged to do what was wrong, but what seemed to them necessary.
Chapter 21. Before Betsy had passed out of the dining room, Oblonsky, who had just come from Elisaev's, where newly arrived oysters were to be had, met her in the doorway.
"Ah, Princess, what a pleasure to meet you," he began. "And I have been at your house."
"We meet only for a moment, as I am just going," said Betsy, smiling and putting on her glove.
"Wait a little, Princess, before putting on your glove. Let me kiss your hand. There is nothing for which I am more thankful than for the revival of the old custom of hand-kissing."
And he kissed Betsy's hand.
"When shall I see you again?"
"You are not worth it," said Betsy, smiling.
"Yes, I am well worth it, because I have become the most serious of men. I not only settle my own, but other people's family affairs," said he with a significant glance.
"Oh, I am very glad," said Betsy, at once understanding that he referred to Anna. She returned to the dining room with him, and they stood together in a corner.
"He will kill her,"
said Betsy in a significant whisper.
"This is impossible. Impossible."
"I'm very glad you think so,"
returned Oblonsky, shaking his head with an expression of grave, woebegone commiseration.
"That is why I have come to Petersburg."
"The whole town is talking of it," she said. "It is an impossible situation. She is fading away, fading away. He does not understand that she is one of those women who cannot play with their feelings. One of two things must happen. Either he must take her away, acting energetically, or he must divorce her. But all this is stifling her."
"Yes. Yes, exactly," said Oblonsky, sighing. "I have come because of that. I mean, not entirely because of it. I have been made chamberlain and had to tender my thanks. But the chief thing is to get this affair settled."
"Well, then, may God help you," said Betsy. Having seen her down to the hall and again kissed her hand, a little above the glove, just where the pulse beat, and having told her some rubbish so daring that she did not know whether to be angry or to laugh, Oblonsky went to his sister's room. He found her in tears. Though he was overflowing with high spirits, Oblonsky immediately fell into a sympathetic and romantic mood suited to hers, inquired after her health, and asked how she had spent the morning.
"Very, very badly. This afternoon and morning and all other days, past and future," she replied.
"I think you give way to melancholy. You should rouse yourself and look life straight in the face. I know it is hard, but..."
"I have heard it said that women love men for their very faults," Anna began suddenly. "But I hate him for his virtues. I cannot live with him.
Try and realize it. Even his looks have a physical effect on me and drive me beside myself. I cannot live with him. What am I to do? I was unhappy and thought it impossible to be more so. But I could never have imagined such a terrible position as I am now in. Will you believe it? Knowing that he is a kind and generous man, that I am not worth his little finger, nevertheless, I hate him. I hate him for his generosity.
There is nothing left for me but..."
She was going to say death, but he did not let her finish.
"You are ill and excited," said he. "Believe me, you're greatly exaggerating the case. There is nothing so very terrible about it."
Oblonsky smiled. No one else in his place, having to deal with such despair, would have permitted himself to smile, for a smile would have appeared callous. But in his smile there was so much kindness and almost feminine tenderness that it was not offensive, but soothing and pacifying. His soft, comforting words and smiles had as soothing and calming an effect as almond oil, and Anna soon felt this.
"No, Stiva," said she, "I am lost. Quite lost. And even worse than lost. I am not lost yet. I cannot say all is finished. On the contrary, I feel that all is not yet finished. I'm like a tightly strung cord which must break. But all is not finished. And it will end in some dreadful manner."
"Oh, no, one can loosen the string, gently. There is no situation from which there is no escape."
"I've been thinking and thinking. Only one..."
Again he understood from her frightened face that she considered death to be the only escape, and did not let her finish.
"Not at all," he replied. "Listen. You can't see your position as I can. Let me tell you my frank opinion."
Again he smiled his almond oil smile.
"I will begin at the beginning. You married a man 20 years older than yourself. You married without love and without having known love. That was a mistake, I grant."
"A dreadful mistake," said Anna.
"But again I say that is an accomplished fact. Next, let us admit that you had the misfortune to fall in love, not with your husband. That is a misfortune, but that too is an accomplished fact. Your husband has accepted that and forgiven you."
He paused between each sentence, expecting her to make objections, but she made no answer.
"That is so. Now comes the question. Can you go on living with your husband? Do you wish it? Does he wish it?"
"I don't know at all."
"But you yourself say you cannot endure him."
"No, I did not say so. I take back those words. I know nothing. I understand nothing." "Yes, but let me..." "You can't understand.
I feel that I'm flying headlong over some precipice, but must not even try to save myself.
And I can't."
"Never mind. We'll spread out something to catch you.
I understand that you cannot take it upon yourself to express your wishes and feelings.
I have no wishes at all.
Except that everything were at an end.
And he sees that and knows it.
Do you think it weighs on him less than on you? You suffer, and he suffers. What can come?